On air, online, on digital, and the ABC Listen app. The Country Hour with Tony Briscoe on ABC Radio Hobart and ABC Northern Tasmania.
And coming up today, bird flu causing talk about free-range egg production.
My parents started as free-range farmers back in the 1960s, and we could not control disease then. That's why we got out of the system. I still believe free-range has its place, but it's meant to be on a small-scale farm. It was never designed for mass production of eggs.
And travelling to China to source greenhouses for growing berries.
Definitely saw that they are doing things differently in the greenhouse production. When we started looking at expanding our market garden, being in Tasmania, you are limited with the environment. You're restricted in that, and you want to control most of it and still be a viable business.
Yeah, the Huon Valley farmer who travelled to China to source greenhouses for the regenerative farm to grow more berries. That story coming up on this Thursday. G'day, Tony Briscoe with you, as we have more news on the spread of bird flu in the south of the country. Details in just a moment, and questions about free-range egg operations, especially large commercial ones, as the bird flu spreads. Also today, part two of our discussion with New South Wales Bee Biosecurity Officer Rod Burke around varroa mite and his advice on how local beekeepers can do their best to prevent the spread of the mite into the state, and if it does get here, how to maybe eradicate the pest. We'll check the weather in around 10 minutes from now, and we'll take you to the Women in Ag conference for more special guests a little bit later in the program. You too can be part of the Country Hour via that text line 0438 922 936. Well, the federal government has confirmed local transmission of the H5 strain of bird flu. It's been detected in South Australia, as there is a reported discovery of bird flu in Victoria for the first time pending official testing. It's the first known local transmission of the deadly and highly contagious virus. It comes after 11 greater crested terns in SA returned positive test results for the HV virus, which has been sent to the CSIRO for confirmation. Here's Agriculture Minister Julie Collins speaking at a media conference alongside Australia's chief vet, Beth Cookson.
Based on testing and sequencing by the CSIRO lab, that some local transmission has occurred between a number of greater crested terns that are resident in South Australia. While there remains no evidence of any mass mortalities at this point in time, we do expect, with this local transmission, that there will be further detections in Australian wildlife. States and territories will continue to undertake activities on the ground, particularly through shared costs to manage the impact of the H5 bird flu. We have also, working with states and territories, now released a further $24 million together with the states and territories. I do want to reiterate, at this point in time, there has been no detections in any poultry or agricultural industries in Australia, and that the risk to human health remains low. We do ask people to continue to keep up to date with the situation at birdflu.gov.au and to remember to not touch dead birds, to report and record, and go to birdflu.gov.au to report it. You would be aware, and we've answered questions before in relation to what's known as housing orders, and that is in terms of bringing free-range hens in undercover, and certainly that would be a decision for states and territories based on the location, the amounts of infections in those areas, and what the disease looks like on the ground in various locations across the country. I don't know if Dr. Cookson would like to add anything to that.
Yeah, that's right, Minister. We have done a lot of work over the last few years with our poultry industries to make sure that their on-farm biosecurity planning is as robust as it can be, and that there is protective measures as far as possible put in place to, again, limit contact between wild birds and poultry, but also to prevent contamination or the feeding of contaminated food or water sources, equipment, basic hygiene and husbandry practices to, as far as possible, prevent spillover. The consideration of enhanced biosecurity, including things like housing orders, will be based on risk-based assessments by the state and territory chief veterinary officers, as we understand the risk. Obviously, Australia is a very big country. We have detections in coastal locations in the south at the moment, so it's really going to be important for us to continue to monitor that situation as it evolves. themselves to know where the virus might be present in wild animals.
Australia's Chief Vet Officer Beth Cooks, and before that you heard from Federal Agriculture Minister Julie Collins with the latest on bird flu confirmation of local transmission in South Australia, and that suspected case for the first time in Victoria in a tern found at Portland on the southwest coast. Well, Victorian Farmers Federation Egg Group President Brian Ahmed says it comes as no surprise to see the spread of the flu.
As farmers, we've been preparing for some time. We were never complacent. We expected that this day would come. It was just a matter of when, if it was going to happen. So I guess farmers, we've gone through, especially here in Victoria, we've gone through avian influenza before. It's a H7 strain, but that has actually helped us prepare a lot better. This strain, the experts tell me, are a lot more virulent, so we are concerned. And we're doing our best to try and keep it out of our commercial flocks. That's the most important thing at this stage. I don't think we can do much about protecting our wildlife. I mean, it's something that we don't have any control over, but I believe as farmers we can control what happens on our farms, and we can keep our birds better protected, especially in this case where we can keep our birds locked up to protect them a lot better than allowing them to roam free.
So further to that point, Brian, what measures have farmers been putting in place?
Well, a lot of farmers have increased their biosecurity on farm. They just don't let people onto farm unless they have to be on there, and they follow the procedures with foot baths and proper clothing and things like that. And the other thing we do is in extreme cases, we will lock up free-range birds. I mean, I know people want free-range eggs, but, I mean, if the best thing is to lock them up to protect them, that's what farmers will do. And this is what we've been trying to say for a long time, is we understand people want free-range eggs, but if we want food security and food affordability in this country, we need to have our cage systems and our barn systems. That's how we can balance the risks.
Do you have a sense of how many free-range operations are able to or have been locking their birds up?
Oh, look, that's very hard to measure, but I think if I was a free-range egg farmer and I was in an area where we found wild birds, I think the first thing I would be doing is locking them up, because it's too late once they're found it on your farm. I mean, they're going to kill all your birds, you know, because we know that the best way to stop the spread of this disease is to eradicate farms. So I think farmers will be locking their birds up. If not totally, they'll be locking them up a lot more now than they would have, say, 12 months ago.
And for the caged or the barn systems, Brian, like yourself, are you Yes. confident that if you follow best practice, you can keep it out of your operation?
Well, I don't believe anyone's 100%, but I believe a cage system is probably 98%, providing you follow the strict biosecurity protocols and make sure that no one comes in or out of your sheds. And, of course, then your barn system is probably 90% secure, because you still can't control vermin and stuff on the ground. I mean, rats and mice can be carriers. And same with smaller birds, they tend to get into sheds. But I guess the biggest ones at risk are our free-range birds. And that's the unfortunate part about letting them roam free. They've got that opportunity mixed with wild birds.
Is there government appreciation, government support of or government flexibility for those free-range operations to maintain their free-range status through this period if they are locking their birds up?
Well, if there's a housing order, there is flexibility there for free-range farmers, but at this stage there hasn't been a housing order. But it's also very clear that farmers need to be prepared. So if they have to lock them up for long periods of time, well, they need to have alternative packaging, because they can't sell them as free-range eggs. So it's a very difficult situation, but, you know, truth in labelling is very important to the Australian consumer, and when they go to buy something, they want to be sure that they're buying what they're paying for.
Should there be that housing order?
Well, I think there comes a time where we will require that. Probably, I don't know about right now, but I've been keeping a close eye on it, and We're only just starting to see it in our local birds, but I'd say we're not far from that. But there's another issue when you do lock up free-range birds. I mean, people don't realise, but once they're used to roaming free and then you lock them up in the sheds, they can cannibalise each other. So we do have a welfare issue if we start to lock them up for long periods of time.
Can Australia eradicate H5, or does it need to accept that it's here to stay and needs to be managed?
I think I've been watching this very closely all around the world because I am an egg farmer and it impacts me very, very much. And I haven't seen any country that's been able to eradicate it totally. They can manage it, but it raises its ugly head again. In other countries, they've cleared it up. They've allowed them to free range again, and then it's popped up again. So I think once we know it's here, we're going to have to learn to live with it and manage it.
You've been advocating for many years now for the biosecurity benefits of caged or barn systems. Do you think now that there could be significant policy change in that space?
Oh, well, I can't guarantee what government decisions they're going to make, but I will continue advocating because I believe, and I've been in this industry long enough, my parents started as free-range farmers back in the 1960s, and we could not control disease then. That's why we got out of the system. I still believe free-range has its place, but it's meant to be on a small-scale farm. It was never designed for mass production of eggs, and I believe we need all our farming systems to assure food security and food affordability in this country. And that's what I've been advocating, and that's what I'll continue to advocate for.
That was VFF Egg Group President Brian Ahmed speaking with Angus Furley about bird flu, biosecurity, free range, and barn fed and caged. A first suspected case of bird flu in Victoria has occurred. Testing will be done in Geelong to confirm whether a bird found in Portland has the H5N1 strain. Now let's check the latest on the weather. Tom Anderson joins us from the Bureau. G'day, Tom.
G'day, Tony.
We had 0.5 of a mil of rainfall here at the ABC studios up until midday.
Yeah, have a little bit more than that for some parts, a little bit further west than you. But yeah, it's sort of been, seen some showery activity about the southeast this morning. That's mostly cleared, and now it's mostly just seeing some showers still about the Huon Valley and then also on the west coast between Strawn and Smithton. But at the moment, the eastern half of the state is looking pretty nice, albeit a little bit windy. In terms of the rainfall that they did get in some parts of the west of the state, over the past 24 hours, the top total we've seen has been around the Huon catchment at Falls Ridge, and we saw 26 millimetres there. Otherwise, we've had a couple of falls just over 20 mil between the Central Plateau and parts of the Western District around Queenstown. So still a little bit of rainfall about, but on an easing trend.
Okay, what's happening with the weather?
Yeah, so going forward, we are going to see these showery activities ease a little bit further into the weekend. So we're going to see the temperatures increase a little bit. Just looking around the state today, we are looking at 12 degrees for Strawn, King Island, Wynyard and Hobart at the moment. Launceston's 11, so is St Helens, whereas Devonport is 13 degrees, as well as Flinders Island. We're expecting to see the maximum temperatures increase a little bit still into the afternoon, but then we are going to get better over the weekend. We're looking at tops more like 15 degrees for Hobart, and then between 14 and 15 degrees for some of the population centres in the northern half of the state. We are also going to see these partly cloudy conditions persist if you are seeing some of the sun at the moment. But if you've got some showery activity at the moment, we are going to see that ease as well through to Saturday before Sunday, especially from the afternoon onwards. We will see the return of some showers, more so about the north coast than the west coast for those showers on Sunday.
What are the temperatures at the moment, Tom?
Yep, so we are looking at 12 degrees for Hobart, King Island, Strawn and Flinders Island. Wynyard's also 12, 13 at the moment for Devonport, and it is 11 in Launceston and St Helens.
Now, do we have any warnings?
The only warnings we have at the moment, Tony, are the strong wind warnings out for the southeast coast and the lower east coast. We did have one for the southwest coast earlier, but that's been cancelled as these winds are easing, and we're not expecting to have any strong winds tomorrow. In terms of what we are expecting on the waters tomorrow, we're looking at west to southwesterly winds between 10 and 20 knots. They'll start tending towards the northwest by the afternoon, and then about the north coast from the afternoon, the winds will ease under that 10-knot level, and then the swells themselves have also been on an easing trend throughout the week. We're looking at a southwesterly swell between 2 to 3 metres for the west and south coast. For the north coast, it's a westerly swell below 1 metre, and on the east coast, looking at a south to southwesterly swell between 1 and 2 metres.
Beauty. Thanks, Tom.
Thanks, Tony.
Cheers. Tom Anderson from the Bureau with the latest information for you on the Country Hour. In just a moment, we'll take you to a farm in the Huon Valley where they've been overseas looking at greenhouses in China. And also we'll hear from the Bee Biosecurity Officer Part 2 from New South Wales, Rod Burke, talking to beekeepers here about how best to protect your hives from varroa mite.
Rick Goddard for breakfast.
Let's get to Trump Tower. We'll have it at Primrose Sands.
How many stories are you thinking?
50, 60, Prim Vegas.
Mornings with Leon Compton.
The Fragrance Group, they proposed a building that I think was 140 stories.
Into it, I love it.
That was right down on the waterfront.
Elegant, it tall.
For everything Hobart.
Elegant,
beautiful.
It would have dominated the Hobart skyline.
Let's put it at Primrose Sands, the Gold Coast of southern Tasmania.
Rick Goddard from 5:30 and Leon Compton from 8:30. Each weekday from 936 ABC Hobart. It's the Country Hour with Tony Briscoe on ABC Radio Hobart and ABC Northern Tasmania.
Well, at the top of the Huon Valley at Mountain River is the Apanocca Farm, a small to medium-scale farm that grows non-certified foods, including egg production, vegetables and berries. Reporter Ronnie Fletcher stopped by to chat to co-partners Thomas and Annette Botta about a recent trip they took to China to inspect greenhouses they're manufacturing over there. They say freight costs are posing the greatest challenge, with half of the cost of transporting goods from China to Hobart coming from the Melbourne to Hobart journey.
We focus predominantly on egg production, pasture-raised eggs, and then we also do beef cattle, lamb, pork, predominantly focusing on small goods, bacon and hams. And then we do a market garden with vegetables, berries.
Yeah. Some fruit.
Some fruit.
Yeah. And what kind of berries do you grow?
We do currently grow strawberries. And we're expanding into blackberries, thornless blackberries, and tayberries, and
boysenberries. How much demand do you think there is in Tassie and in Australia as well for organic foods and for fresh foods? Like, how important is that, do you think, to people?
The increase in media exposure to healthy living increases the demand for organic food. The other thing is what's happening now is the increase of production and the increase of cost under commercial and traditional farming. Organic farming is becoming more and more feasible and affordable for most people.
And in terms of organic berries, how much demand do you think there is in Australia and Tasmania for specifically organic berries?
There's a number of berry producers that you can buy berries directly from. And one of the alarm things for me is that if you go in for berry picking and they tell you to wash the berries before you eat it, we believe that you should be able to live off the land. Don't put poison on food that you want to eat. Answering that in a long way is that, yes, we believe there is a demand if you want to direct sell. And that won't change because people want to feel the experience with it. And that's difficult to put that in a packet and sell it. People want to see where it is. Yeah.
They want to be part of the experience as well. Mm. Adds to the demand for it.
Yeah, so we do farm tours as well, especially in the season. And then we take people through our production. So we show them the poultry and the chickens and the beef. And we normally end up in the market garden. So in summer, spring, that's ideal because you end up with the berries in season.
You've just come off the back of a trip to China. Can you tell me about what the main takeaways from that were and why you were over there?
This specific trip was to do the final inspections on greenhouses that we are manufacturing in China. Taking that a little bit back, I've been in China and East Asia a few times, and definitely saw that they are doing things differently in the greenhouse production. When we started looking at expanding our market garden, being in Tasmania, you are limited with the environment. You're restricted in that, and you want to control most of it and still be a viable business. So most of the greenhouses that you can get in Australia and Tasmania are focused on small farm production. So it's very expensive if you want to go and increase them to, let's say, an acre or 2 acres. If you want to increase it to 1 or 2 or 3 hectares, then you start looking at large commercial enterprises, which doesn't make it viable for us in that transition period. So yes, we designed it with a Chinese manufacturer and tried to get it bespoke to for our use and our ability to install it. We get the Chinese manufacturer to bend it to according to our specifications, all the hoops. That's normally bent on farm in Australia on bigger scale. And that gives us the advantage whereby we can actually install a big greenhouse our own because we worked with the manufacturer. The way that we decided the technology we want to utilize is not so much on our China investigation. We've been farming now on this specific farm for over 4 or 5 years, and we've seen a few methodologies that works. We were recently on the Sprout Development Program in Tasmania, and in that we saw a few farms and the crop protection that they utilize. We also recently signed on the Market Gardeners Masterclass, which is by JM Frontier. And we looked at Canadian production. And the reason why we looked at Canadian production, the weather patterns that we that is experienced in Canada is similar to Tasmania or worse. The next step, which is a nightmare for us, is importing and freighting it from China.
Talk to me about the cost of freight, getting freight from China to Tasmania and what you're noticing.
That was one of the main things that why we started looking at China, manufacturing in China supply as well, because we realized the freight cost from the mainland to Tasmania was exceptionally high. The freight cost that we currently have to transport it from China to here, 50% of that cost is transporting the goods from Melbourne down to Hobart. So we have a shipping container that's transported over 1,000 kilometers on mainland China to a harbor, loaded on a ship, and that's costing the same as transporting something on our ferry through 300 kilometers.
And what effect do you think that has on deterring farmers here?
The cost of startup is almost not impossible, but it makes it extremely difficult for a farm to start up. Farms are very capital intensive. And to get a viable business model whereby you can go to a investor or to your own investments and go, we want to start vegetable production and this is what we require, almost doesn't make it feasible.
That's Abenaco Regenerative Farm co-partners Thomas and Nanette Bertha talking to reporter Ronnie Fletcher about their trip to China to source greenhouses for their berry production. On the country hour, let's turn to bees now. And yesterday on the program, we heard from the New South Wales Bee Biosecurity Officer, Rod Burke. He was the guest speaker at the recent Tasmanian Beekeepers Conference in Launceston. Rod Burke told the gathering about how beekeepers in New South Wales have been struggling with hive health since the Varroa mite was detected in the port of Newcastle 4 years ago. He also spoke about how the drop in commercial beekeeper numbers has affected the honeybee industry and the pollination sector.
That peaked at 1,350 in 23, and now as of 2026, it is 886 commercial registered beekeepers. So there's been a significant drop. Varroa has had an impact, not necessarily on every one of those commercials that has left the industry, but Varroa's definitely had a big impact on a lot of those that have.
And Rod, we haven't mentioned the feral bee population. That's an even more worrisome thing, isn't it?
Well, the feral bees, a lot of beekeepers have always looked at feral bees as their competition. A lot of pollination-reliant industries have benefited from feral bees giving free pollination and all that, but for people with managed hives, feral bees have always been out there stealing some of the nectar that our beehives could have got. And so what we have seen is that when varroa moves into any area, generally within 6, 12, 18 months at the longest, all of the feral beehives in the area have died out from varroa. And then after that, the only feral bees that you'll get are from beekeepers that aren't managing swarming. And their bees will swarm in spring. And then by autumn or going into winter, often those same colonies are dying out from varroa again. So there's been a massive impact on the feral bee population. It's basically non-existent. There are probably small numbers that will survive, but it's quite an insignificant number. On the good side, beekeepers that have been able to keep the bees alive have found that their hives do slightly better and they get a bit more honey. So there's been a bit of a silver lining in that regard. But from the pollination-reliant agricultural industry, they've seen some major crop failures because they didn't have the pollination they thought they would have because feral bees weren't there.
What's your final message to Tasmanian beekeepers and people who are hobby beekeepers in the state?
The very first thing you need to do is start looking for varroa mite by doing an alcohol wash. Don't look at the sugar shake because it might save some of those bees. To save bees, you need to be prepared to kill about half a cup of bees regularly to monitor the varroa mite. And whilst people in Tasmania are still under the opinion that they don't have varroa mite, they won't know if they don't look, and they'll be in exactly the same boat as it was in New South Wales. A lot of beekeepers said, we don't have varroa mite, so I'm not really going to look. And they didn't really look. There weren't very good returns for sugar shake month in April 22. Only a small percentage of New South Wales beekeepers put in a result. And it turns out that we found mite soon after that. So please, every Tasmanian beekeeper, do an alcohol wash. Take a half cup of brood bees. Put them in, do your wash. In Tasmania, you'll definitely get brawler. They're a cute little bug, which is a similar size to varroa but a different shape. But please get familiar with alcohol washing. And if you find anything that looks suspicious, please contact your bee biosecurity officer or call the plant pest hotline, because you need to get the people out as soon as possible to have a look to confirm what you may or may not have. So don't be shy. Get out there. Do an alcohol wash and please be vigilant, because if it is found early in Tasmania, there is still a chance that you could eradicate it. But if it's gone too far, you'll be dealing with varroa mite forever afterwards.
That's Rod Burke, the New South Wales Bee Biosecurity Officer, talking about precautions Tasmanian beekeepers must take to try and keep the varroa mite out of the state. Well, still to come on today's edition of The Country Hour, I will take you to the National Women in Agriculture Conference in Orange. A couple of very interesting guests coming up, and details of the 10th anniversary Old Mates Day this weekend as well. First up, let's check the latest news headlines with Michael Della Fontana.
Thank you, Tony. The Communications Minister, Anika Wells, is welcoming court action against Optus following the telco's major outage last year. The Australian Communications and Media Authority is alleging Optus breached its legal obligations because customers couldn't access emergency calls. Hundreds of calls to 000 failed during the 14-hour outage in September, which has also been linked to two deaths. Optus says it's inappropriate to comment on current legal matters, but it continues to invest in network resilience. Australians are being urged not to panic buy petrol before the federal government's cut to the fuel excise comes to an end. The current 16 cent per litre discount will end on Sunday, as planned, despite global oil prices rising again due to the conflict in the Middle East. Kevin Morrison from the Institute for Energy Economics and Financial Analysis says Australia has plenty of fuel supply. And Hawthorne Football Club will use its final Launceston game for 2026 to raise awareness about road safety. The Hawks play North Melbourne at York Park on Saturday afternoon. Road trauma remains the second leading cause of death for Tasmanians aged between 17 and 25. More news at 1 o'clock.
Kylie Baxter for Drive.
Still got that feel on the roads. Outbound on the Brooker, slow past Risdon Road.
Evenings with Helen Shield.
Gav, what is on your shirt?
Apart from the scraps of me lunch, I've got a Grinspoon shirt on.
Yay! For everything Hobart.
There's one tonight. Back, baby. Yeah. And it's because of all the Winnie the Pooh-ness last night. It's Quiztopher Robin.
Quiztopher. Yeah. Okay. Kylie Baxter from 4 and Helen Shield from 6:30. 936 ABC Hobart.
On air, online, on digital, and the ABC Listen app. This is The Country Hour with Tony Briscoe on ABC Radio Hobart and ABC Northern Tasmania.
Just a reminder, plenty of great stories on our ABC Rural page and also ABC Rural Facebook page. And just repeating that a bird flu strain of H5N1 has been found in Portland, off the southwest coast of Victoria, and they're taking it for testing at the Geelong lab just to make sure that it is that strain. But that would be the first time bird flu has been found in Victoria, getting closer and closer to Tasmania. Not good. Now let's take you to the central west of New South Wales, where the National Women in Agriculture Conference was held this week. At every type of conference, the guest speakers are vital for a successful event, as is the Master of Ceremonies, the MC. Claire Taylor had that duty at the conference and spoke to reporters Emily Middleton and Amelia Bernasconi.
I come from Scotland, lived in Orange now for a year and a half, and before that I'd been doing an off-field farming scholarship, so I'd been travelling around the world for just over a year, and then I fell in love with an Australian beef farmer, and here for my sins, I'm now moved over here in Orange, but we're actually just farming about 15 minutes outside of here.
Beautiful, but you're no stranger to a beef operation. Is that where you grew up in Scotland?
I did, so we've got a small beef farm in the west coast of Scotland in a place called Ayrshire, and we've got Belted Galloway cattle, which aren't as common a sight here in Australia, but where we're from in Scotland, they're local to where we are, which they're wonderful, but now we're farming Angus here, so we've got a breeding operation. But that's just the sort of day thing for me, but mostly I'm a moderator of agricultural conferences. I've been doing that actually since I've moved to Australia for the last sort of year, but before that I was sort of travelling and moderating all over the world, so I've been very, very lucky.
Wow, you must have drawn some incredible comparisons, I guess, to, you know, now living in Australia and what we do here, like you said, the Angus over the Belties these days. But what else, I guess, has taken your interest around the world that you know could share with our audience?
So what sort of led to me doing quite a lot of travel was when I was working in Scotland as a journalist, I'd very much been seeing farming becoming, I guess, a centre point in conversations in society around climate change, biodiversity, food security. And at the time, a lot of farmers that I was working with felt very threatened. They felt like they were being asked lots of questions, having to prove what they were doing. And there was this sort of, I guess, that the word that kept coming up was this anti-farming sentiment, that they felt they were under attack. And I didn't really maybe think that myself when I was working, but that's what farmers were telling me. So I sort of decided to travel to see, are farmers around the world feeling like this? Do they feel that they're under scrutiny, and how are they sort of reacting to what's happening, and how are we communicating as a response to that? So that's sort of what I went out to sort of find out, is this sort of a familiar feeling and sentiment everywhere that I went? And I quickly found out that if you go looking for conflict, you'll certainly find it, and you'll find those sort of small minority groups that are particularly loud and being quite aggressive in their thoughts towards agriculture. But when you actually step back, the public sentiment and support for the industry was absolutely huge. But I think it's sometimes when we're in a bit of an echo chamber, we don't see it, we don't hear it. So that was a very interesting part of my work.
So that was for the Nuffield Scholar?
That was my Nuffield Scholarship, yes.
Do you have any other, I suppose, examples of individuals who have built these good relationships with the general public?
Yeah, so lots of people always say to me, is there a country or is there a real example that we can learn from? But really it was just individual people and organisations that collectively weren't maybe seeking to be advocates about agriculture, but they were much more focused on relationship building and looking at trust. And I think at the moment, and even today at the conference, we're talking a lot about advocacy, and a lot of that is towards kind of politics and campaigning. But I think something in agriculture which has definitely evolved is a bit of a relationship gap, and we feel disconnected to the public, and maybe people don't understand what we do. And what I realised for some of these individuals that I was meeting around the world, that's actually on agriculture to invest more in having organisations which are maybe stepping up at times where it's not just about agriculture, it's about wider society. It's about opening gates on farms, whether that's through agritourism, which I know is really, really developed in the UK, and it's coming on leaps and bounds here in Australia, and just forging touch points for connection. And then I met with wonderful communicators around the world, and recently I was very lucky, I met with Lisa Hogan from Clarkson Farm, and she really talked to me quite a lot about some of the work that they've been doing and leveraging on the success of Clarkson. I mean, you're talking millions and millions of people that are now reunited in the humanity of farming, and she's just launched a platform called Only Farmers, which is basically about creating touch points on farms for the public to get onto farms, not to learn about farming or to educate, but just develop an experience and a relationship with agriculture. So there's just hundreds of people collectively around the world doing all these different things. Not all of them were leaders, not all of them had big impressive titles, but they were just sort of having those day-to-day conversations that collectively make an impact.
I suppose one of of the bigger issues that a lot of the farmers, particularly around here in the Central West and all across New South Wales, is they'd say, you know, we already have limited time to just get our farming done day to day. So opening up the farm gate, while it's a brilliant sentiment, it can be quite impossible for these smaller family farms who are only being run by 2, 3, 4 people. I suppose for those people who are struggling with the time sort of thing, where should they, how should they go about trying to introduce people more into bringing more people into the agricultural world?
It's a question I get asked quite a lot, because you're absolutely right. Not everybody has the time to open their gates. Not everybody probably are people and want to be at that consumer-facing point either. But I think it's more about recognising, what do you all already do in society? Are you mentoring young people as part of programmes? Are you sitting on local community boards? Are you doing a lot of work with supporting your neighbours? I think people underestimate the different conversations and interactions that we have in wider society. All of that is influencing, and it's change, and it's connecting. But I think a lot of people think they've got to be potentially opening farms, or they've got to be great communicators or social media influencers. And something that I keep saying when I do keynotes at different conferences, there's so many different ways that you can build connection. And if maybe it's somebody that is particularly busy, it's actually looking around at others who are being more ambassadors. And how do you endorse and support them? Because I think sometimes in agriculture, there's a bit of a tall poppy syndrome, where we sort of pull down those who are trying to make an impact and really sort of push for innovation and ideas. But actually, it's supporting others as well who are already down that track. So there's just so many different ways you can throw your weight behind it.
I guess before we let you go, though, what has it been like networking with women from right across the country? And sort of being, I'm at a loss for words of what it feels like to be in that room this morning.
It's just been amazing. And actually, the word networking, they've just had a session with Kathy McGowan actually talking about how we can be more effective and the way that we network and be very intentional behind that. And it's something, I think we all get intimidated when we go into rooms, where to begin, where to start. And I'm someone that spends a lot of time on the road at conferences on my own and moderating, and I get quite nervous and people would be surprised at me saying that. So she was just giving really great tips, and as part of that process, I've already met 4 or 5 women I've never met before from all over the country, which is exactly what this conference is all about. So it's been wonderful.
That's Orange Farmer Claire Taylor, who was the centre of attention at the National Women in Agriculture Conference this week, where she was the MC, speaking there to Amelia Bernasconi and Emily Middleton. One of the guest speakers at the event was a 6th-generation farmer who runs a very diverse operation at Eugowra in the central west of NSW. Caitlin Herbert and Mother Tess caught up with the two reporters at the event and spoke about collaboration and succession planning.
There is a lot of pressure, and there's always that pressure to maintain and respect the heritage of the generations who've been there before me, but while continuously changing and improving the way that we farm in Australia.
It's a big privilege, I imagine, as well, to run forward. For those who aren't as familiar with your operation there, the feedlot is centre to it all, but you do a lot out at Gundamain.
Yeah, Eugowra's, we're in this wonderful place in Australia where it's just made for mixed farming, so we're lucky enough to feedlot cattle, we breed sheep, we crop and we produce our own hay.
My goodness. And so what does your day-to-day look like?
Well, I'm not too sure what a usual day looks like. And that's part of the beauty of working in agriculture. One day I can be working in the yards, one day I can be riding a horse, and another day I'm stuck in front of a computer doing compliance.
Well, we know what you'd rather be doing. I think most of us can relate to being outdoors and that sort of lifestyle. You've been invited to speak at the conference today. Tell us about the session you're part of.
Yeah, I'm very fortunate enough here to be speaking on a producer panel representing those of us who are farming in the Central West. I'm excited to speak a little bit like I spoke about on collaboration. Mm. We're in a room today of over 250 women, a sold-out show today, and this is what women have always done well. We've collaborated in the past, we talk, we produce new ideas, and that when you put 250 of us in a room, it's a pretty exciting time.
Yeah, sometimes we get, women talk too much, but I think maybe just enough.
I think just enough.
Shall we bring in Tess here as well?
This is Tess Herbert. How are you going, Tess?
I'm well, thank you.
And you're the lovely mother of Caitlin here. You're not speaking today.
No.
But as Caitlin's mother, it was something that we've always come back to is succession planning when it comes to farming. This is something I'm sure you've spoken about in depth between yourselves, but also with other farmers. But it is something that a lot of people... I don't have the number off the top of my head, but a lot of farming families don't quite have a written succession plan in place, and they just sort of go off word of mouth what they've spoken about. And as Caitlin is now the sixth generation farmer in your family for Gundamain, I suppose, where does succession planning come into your everyday ag work?
Oh, look, it's a really important part of everything we do. We do plan a lot. So in all the plans that we do, like business planning, financial planning, sustainability planning, Caitlin's currently planning for a proposed expansion. In all of that planning, we've done succession planning because it's just part of our DNA that we plan. So we're part of the way through the process of succession planning, and I'm very grateful that at my time of life now, I can have some certainty about what happens with the business now that Caitlin and her husband Ed are back working on the farm with us.
Absolutely, and having these young guns who are ready to take on that next step and to take on the farm and whatnot, that makes it a lot easier. But for farming families who might not have that, I suppose, what would your advice be to going forward, just to make sure that the farm continues or children are left in a good place?
I think everyone's looking for some certainty around succession planning, and it's not a we've got here and finished this process at all. I know it will take years to cement what we've started talking about, but we now have some certainty amongst Caitlin and her brother and her sister as to what everyone would like to happen, what their ideal is, what their hopes for the future are, and what my husband Andrew and I, what our hopes for the future are as well. So we're on the same page, basically. We've had those early, sometimes difficult discussions, but we've had those discussions and we can move on with the planning process from here.
Sometimes you've got to rip the band-aids off and start the conversations. That's right. And they have to get easier, right?
Yeah. And because we've now got that certainty that I was talking about. So it does get easier. We can work from here on. Now it's a more structured process, financial planning, the legals, all of that, the business structure, what that looks like to enable our succession planning to work.
You can hear the passion from Caitlin as well about respecting the heritage, but also not being scared to adapt and change, you know, like any good business has to do. What does that mean to you to see that, the next generation with that, you know, quite nuanced, balanced approach?
Oh, look, I already know they have skills that I don't have. So I'm really grateful they've come back because they've brought another layer of insight and strategy to the business, which has led us to a growth pattern. And I know in our early days we were in a growth phase too, but it's just stepped it up a notch. It's accentuated the planning and really been strategic about the how we operate day to day, but what will happen in the future as well for the business.
But certainly exciting times, Caitlin. I guess, can you talk to us about that expansion? And is a lot of the feedlot for export?
So we produce for two different markets, a local supermarket to Australia and another program which does have an export component to it. But excitingly, as we know, the Australian feedlot industry, the growth has just been so rapid. We've over doubled in the past 10 years. Right. And I think to remain competitive in this market, we have to expand ourselves. But we also have to look at new ways of doing things. So feedlotting in the south, we're looking at covered housing for our cattle to improve welfare, comfort and productivity, which I still think sits below those two.
There's been a lot of conversations too around feedlots and in regards to its energy output and that sort of thing, and it being a, sort of a way forward has been part of the conversation, particularly with MLA. They've been saying that they've been investing quite a bit of money into it. I guess going forward, knowing that you have that support from MLA, I suppose, how does that feel for you then planning for the future?
Yeah, I commend MLA and ALFA on their representation of the feedlot industry in Australia. It really is an industry that the growth shows just how competitive we can be in a market. And it's really important to remember too that feedlotting is not the be-all end-all. It is a supply chain, and we are just one small portion in that supply chain.
That's Yugara farmers Caitlin and Tess Herbert speaking to reporters Amelia Bernasconi and Emily Middleton at this week's National Women in Agriculture Conference in Orange. Now, further to our breaking news today, the deadly H5 strain of bird flu has been detected in Victoria. Testing is still underway to confirm that. But here's Victoria's Chief Vet Officer, Dr. Graham Cook.
I can confirm today that we have had initial confirmatory results for a H5N1 detection in a single wild bird, a tern, in the Portland area. The sample has undergone testing at our state laboratory and also initial preliminary positive results at our Australian Centre for Disease Preparedness in Geelong. We have been watching the progress of H5N1 across the world as it's made its way down into South America and into the subantarctic region. We know it arrived in Australia on the 20th of June, and we have been watching its progress as it was detected in Western Australia, in South Australia, New South Wales and Queensland. We also know that this virus can cause effects in the wildlife sector, the number of birds affected in that sector, and also in marine mammals. We have been preparing for this event for some time as we have watched its progress. We do not have the virus detected in our commercial poultry, nor has that happened anywhere in Australia. As part of our preparedness, we have been working with the industry. We've been working right across government with a whole of government plan. And we, of course, have been looking at how effects can be mitigated, both in the commercial poultry sector and also in the wildlife sector. We recognise that this can be unsettling news for members of our community, for our wildlife sector and also for our commercial poultry sector. We have people on the ground in the Portland area where this tern was detected. This particular bird was found in a domestic residence. Grateful to the member of the public who reported it. It was triaged through our system. Not every bird is tested. You will understand there's a difference between a normal domestic bird that flies into a window or a bird that of a long-range migratory seabird type.
That's Victoria's Chief Vet, Dr. Graham Cook, speaking there about the first confirmed case of H5N1 bird flu in Victoria at Portland. Well, several hundred Tasmanian farmers and their families are expected to gather in south of the state on Saturday for the annual Old Mates Day. One of the organisers of the event is vineyard farmer Dennis Turner, who runs horses on his property.
Well, it's the 10th anniversary this year, Tony, of the Old Mates Day that's held at Terry White's place at High Frith at Wattle Hill. We're hoping for a good crowd, and normally there are a good crowd there, 250 last year. And we're encouraging some of the younger fellas, just we call it Old Mates Day. I mean, it doesn't matter if you're 30. If you had a mate for a long time, he's an old mate. You don't have to be in the senior ages to just qualify to come. So we're trying to encourage some of the younger fellas involved in the agricultural industry, be they on farms or machinery sales or whatever, to come along, because as you and I both know, Tony, the next 10 years is going to be a challenge for a lot of us older people, and it'll be a shame just because of the lack of, I wouldn't say interest, but the lack of, well, venue or whatever, this sort of thing fell over because it's just so successful.
Yeah, and you want families to come along too, don't you?
Absolutely, mate, yeah. Families can come along, mums and, you know, the dads, of course, and kids and uncles and aunts and grandparents and goodness knows what. We can cater for all. I mean, Terry's very, very good, of course, to allow us the use of his property in the undercover area. He's got everything set up at the moment. Heaps of firewood for the huge potbelly stoves, which need to be seen to be believed. They're like stacks of steam engines. But yes, courage, everyone. If the ladies, you know, if they're coming, bring a plate or something like that for the few sandwiches on it, it'll be good. But the barbecue meat will be supplied, and just bring along whatever you want to drink.
It's pretty good, an idea out of nowhere, and having the 10th anniversary of it. I can remember talking to you all those years ago about when it was first sort of being mooted, and it's been a great success, hasn't it?
It has. It sort of started in a couple of areas. Chop Cusick, or Chris Cusick, when he was with Roberts, he decided and sought Terry to have a bit of a get-together with the stock agents and the field people out there at around the Christmas time or something like that. And that was so successful because they caught up in an environment that was more relaxed than it, you know, the breast bar at the sale yard and that sort of thing. And then when I heard about that, we got involved and I said, well, look, this could extend into the wider community because of the mental health, if you like, of some of our people, particularly through the drought years, and then the lack of clearing sales and stock sales, regional sales. It wasn't an opportunity, or the opportunity to get together and put your hand, your foot on the rail and talk about the weather, whatever, just didn't exist. And we thought, well, look, we can go to this, take this to the wider community, which we did, and it's been very successful. Yes.
And the idea is just to meet up, have a yak and say good day and just enjoy yourself.
That's right. I mean, some of the fellas that come probably didn't see their old mate until the same time last year. And, of course, it's really good to just sit and have a yarn and, yeah, okay, we may talk about the same things we talked about last year, but it doesn't matter. We've probably forgotten about it anyhow, so it's good to bring it up again. But, no, it is good. It's nice to see the people relax and talk about just what's going on over the other side of the fence, you know.
Yeah, now you've got a story to tell with the horses. What happened today?
Well, we run a riding school. My wife runs a riding school up here, which we brought up from Orielton when we came. And it's a nice little spot, 12 acres of flat ground and electrically fenced. But for whatever reason, last night when I took the dog out for a walk, I noticed that one of the fences down our driveway was laying over a bit. And I thought, that's a bit strange. So a closer look with the spotlight, I thought, crikey. And one of our middle fences wasn't there. I think one of the things that made it less injurious to the horse, the ground is so wet up here at Tony at the moment, the steel post just fell up, you know, pulled out of the ground, lay over, the wooden post just lay over. And I'm not sure what happened, but the three older horses we got here, one of them got spooked, took a fence out, probably, well, I don't know, 50 metres of fence completely, did a few laps around the round barrel, that's where most of the wire is, and then we think decided to jump the driveway fence and was successful in doing that after nearly knocking the fence over. And anyhow, we located them. One was on the dressage already, quite calm, and the other two were quite calm. We're not sure whether they got spooked or not, or they might have got caught in the fence.
Yeah.
But as you know, a horse that gets scared, all it knows what to do is to kick and run, and that's what they do. And that's what they did. So I've been out there in the cold weather, gumboots, recovering fencing.
Doing your old fencing job. Now, you said it's been pretty wet up there. Have you had enough rain?
Oh, it's easy to say we've had enough rain because, the horses are bogged in up their knees and the ploughs are in four-wheel drive all the time. But if we get this dry spring they forecast, Tony, then this rain is going to be very beneficial. I don't suppose there's even enough, but it's certainly wet at the moment, yes.
Okay. Well, good luck with Old Mate's Day at the weekend. Just briefly, where is it at and what time?
It starts about 10 and usually it finishes when Wayne Newitz decides to leave, which is probably dark. At 10 till about 4, yes, it's at High Frith, which is on the Wattle Hill Road towards Nugent. I think it's 681. Got a little bit of sign posted on the gate, and you'll soon see down Terry's driveway to the left, the silos around the big shed, and the car's parked, and yes, most welcome to come along.
Yeah, Wynyard farmer Dennis Turner talking about the 10th gathering of farming families on Saturday at Old Mates Day at Nugent. I'll put a podcast of today's program up for you. ABC Rural and ABC Rural Online Facebook page. We'll catch you after midday tomorrow.